Well, now you've been watching Sunday at the Cathedral. I'm Dr. Gene Scott, and the closings that we can't wait on. We're on satellite GE3 transponder 24 hours a day. We're on the internet 24 hours a day. Sound, there's a page, our home page, but we also, you can hit various entry servers, and you can watch 24 hours a day and listen on the internet. When they're up to snuff as a staff, the Sunday message is put on the internet the same week, and you can listen to it in sound. I just hit the ceiling a few weeks ago when I found out that they were still putting it on in sound before we ever got the servers. That's the only way we could put it on the internet for you. But then we got picture now. And I'm screaming and hollering in my inimitable gentle way as I was looking at some other television ministry, and you could go to their various messages and it would come up just like our sound and picture service live. Why can I only pull up on my home page audio sermons? Why can't I pull up video communions and video messages? We got the servers to be live, so we can't use the servers, I guess. I'm getting there, folks. And I'm going to have a few surprises for you that I think you're going to rejoice over, but you're going to rise to the challenge as a congregation, too. I want your reservations this afternoon. I'm exactly 200 short of where I should be at this time. It doesn't take that long. I got a house full of voices of faith. Don't make speeches. Just make your reservation. Get on the telephone and make your reservations for next Sunday. And the following Sunday is Anniversary Sunday, my 26th anniversary. That makes some people happy. Makes some, not in my congregation, but it makes my enemies sad because their prayers have not been answered. And a lot of my enemies are dead. They just died of old age or retired. And that retirement tells me all that I or God needs to know about them. I cannot fathom a preacher retiring. I'd like them better if they were retreads than retires. How can a preacher, how could the Apostle Paul retire? I'm going to be around a long time. This afternoon I want to talk about some of the events that are hitting us in the background of this Islamist terrorism. And I'm still insulted by the government that continues to treat this terrorism from the frame of reference of a criminal act. We have declared war. I don't care about the semantical nonsense. You can't declare war on a nation with people that are not national in their thought patterns. We're dealing with clans. We're dealing with a pan-Islamic nation. We're dealing with state boundaries that are used as a convenience, drawn by westernized nations that had no comprehension of the religious frames of reference in the area, where a territory once occupied by his lamb is forever his lamb's. The same attitude that the strict Zionists had, that Canaan was forever, wherever Abraham walked with his feet. Now, that didn't have a thing to do with national boundaries drawn up by a bunch of snooty British generals, politicians, and others of the First World War, just taking a map and drawing lines on a piece of paper that had nothing to do with clans or any other of the historic definitive factors. I want to talk about these things, but I'm insulted with the media and with the government. The media is not as bad as the government in this case, telling us that we have no evidence linking these anthrax letters to terrorism. In war, the War Departments and the Secretary of Defense move ahead of the Attorney General. I'm sorry. And that's what caused us to fail when the place was bombed the last time. And it was treated under the auspices of the criminal laws and the protections that reside there when you're dealing with terrorists that have declared war. Bin Laden, the man who declared war on America, and he did it long ago and several times, and he did it under the protection, not openly testified to, of sovereign states who utilized the benefits of national sovereignty to protect and hide and facilitate and to give them deniability for the instrument of their policy, of which Bin Laden is just the most prominent, most effective, and at one time the richest. Under criminal law, you are presumed innocent until proven guilty. In wartime, if you look like the enemy, walk like the enemy, and quack like the enemy, you are the enemy. We cannot fight this war on terrorism, tying our hands behind our back, and making defense attorneys rich. Those matters are sorted out after the war is won. A lot more to say about that, because we're being told there is no evidence. Well, you got to be minus 80 IQ to think that these anthrax activities are unrelated to the war against the American people, the terrorism that we're supposed to be stamping out. It makes about as much sense for us to have people get on the radio and on the TV that represent us in government and tell us that we must have proof in a court of law, probable cause, and presume innocent until proven guilty here, and then ignore that same argument being given by the Taliban. We will not deliver Bin Laden over until he is tried and proven guilty. Smells like a skunk. You shoot the first white-tailed thing that goes by. Period. You do not hire chemists to analyze the smell while we're dying from the stink. It's wartime. We're being insulted because we're a nation that's going to go berserk and panic if we tell them that This is probably terrorism. And we're going to treat them accordingly. I think America's got more common sense than most of those in government. Certainly most of those in media. And by the way, I don't think I have ever seen... Who's that guy can't talk plain on Channel 4 out here? I mean, I've never seen Brokaw so mad. I mean, when it comes close to home, they lose their neutrality. Now, there's only one of two things that are happening. Either the terrorists are doing it, or the anti-terrorists are trying to work up the news media. In either case, it has to do with it. That was a joke, by the way. The terrorists are doing it. The terrorists are doing it. And I heard one of the best commentaries I've heard yet. Somebody that honestly said in the media that we're fighting this war the right way, so we aren't letting the news media out there. They probably don't want to be there with all the landmines that are scattered around Afghanistan. So they go and interrupt guys of the so-called Northern Alliance playing volleyball and ask them to stage a training session so they can then take pictures of it and bring it on the media in the lack of news of how the Northern Alliance is training so hard, and as soon as the cameras stop running, they go back playing volleyball. We're not going to get the truth, but we're at war, and I still think that those Texas roots in Bush, I still admire him, dead or alive. Hunt them out, smoke them out, bomb them out, drive them out. If that doesn't work, resurrect Harry Truman from the grave. He knows what to do. But I've got plenty to say. Get on the telephone! Well, here's from Oxnard. Got the message. I want to tell Doc that on the way home from the cathedral with my family, somebody threw a rock on an overpass and shattered my windshield. I thank God none of us got hurt. Next Saturday night, I'll be in as a voice of faith. Thank you, Pastor. That's right. Oh, my God, how did this happen to me? No, thank God we're safe. Now, if you can do anything about catching that terrorist on that overpass, wonderful. There are people all over Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles, that live nightly and daily with terrorists, the product of this lax society and the corruption, gangs, robbery, shootings, and yet the media is trying to panic America with this biochemical warfare. Yes, it's very serious and very real. You have a much greater chance of getting killed on the way home on these Los Angeles freeways than you do getting a piece of mail with anthrax on it. Does that mean you shouldn't be wise? Yes. Start taking Cipro before you need it? No. That'll ensure it won't work when you do need it. But look up, your redemption draweth nigh. Let me tell you the most important thing that is happening. The most terrible thing, but the most important. Conclusion to be drawn from all that has just happened in America. How many years have I been telling you that Antichrist cannot come to power until the First Amendment of the United States Constitution is broken? Antichrist cannot come to power. Until this wonderful country established a la Romans 13 under God's plan, the only country formed with a contract between the people and the government that's made possible the carrying of the gospel to the world. Antichrist cannot come to power. Antichrist will not conquer the United States. There's a chapter in Isaiah that if I were on prophecy teaching, I would take you to. That the rest of the world needs to be fearful about this country being roused even at the end. Oh, I know. There's a lot of popular stuff going on being spread in the name of Christianity that's just false doctrine. Antichrist will not be conquered by, or rather the other way around, the United States will not be conquered by Antichrist. Well, they may cooperate, particularly economically. Antichrist will not rise out of Europe. There is no little boy growing up anywhere in the world that is the Antichrist with these superhuman evil powers doing terrible things to kids on the block and his sister with miraculous evil powers. It may be, if this is the end, that the man that will become Antichrist is alive and well somewhere on this earth. He will come to power in the territory of the Seleucid Kingdom, one of those places divided among Alexander the Great's generals. But the book of Daniel says they will stand in Alexander's place geographically, but not in his power. If they had his power, the Prince of Grecia, they would not ever be conquered. No one could explain the Prince of Persia. And it was not an earthly prince. Gabriel, who brought the message to Daniel, could not and was delayed bringing his answer of prayer to Daniel by the Prince of Persia, would not have made it through without the help additional of the Prince of Princes, Michael. Instantly we know we're not talking about earthly princes. We're talking about a hierarchy of demonic, not even demonic, fallen angel princes that are assigned their hegemony, their territories, archos, under the Prince of the Power of the Air, who is the Prince of the Power of the Air, rules this earth apart from those that are in Christ, and got his power because of Adam's default. Nowhere will you find Jesus telling Satan in the temptation that he did not have the power to give to Jesus all the kingdoms of this earth. His final temptation, the appeal to pride, taking him to a high pinnacle and telling him to survey and showing him all the kingdoms of this earth. I'll give you that if you'll bow to me. Jesus didn't say, what are you talking about? You don't have the power to give me that. Not yours to give. Yes, it was. Because a faithful God who keeps his word gave to him. Oh, he could have said, but it would have been premature. You ain't going to give it to me. I'm going to wrest it out of your hands. which he did, and took from him the keys to death, hell, and the grave also, and will come as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and put him down and throw him in the lake of fire. But in the meantime, the devil still rules this earth. He has his princes, and it was a prince of Persia that withstood Gabriel, and he said, when I go back, Michael and I will fight him, and he'll be no more. And no historian has ever been able to explain the vacuum of this Persian empire that conquered everything, then overnight is powerless and helpless, while the prince of Grecia comes like a scythe across the earth, until Alexander the Great sits down and cries, no more kingdoms to conquer. And some evil prince entered into him as he consulted the oracle in Egypt and gave him superhuman power. A prince of Grecia dwelled in him. And that prince of Grecia, when Alexander was over, his successors, the generals with whom he divided the kingdom, would stand in his place but not in his power. There will rise up in that area of the Seleucid kingdom a man, and in that area will conquer too, and will become the little horn. But it's not until, and certainly guided by Satan, but not until midway in the Great Tribulation, or in the tribulation before it becomes the Great, that a beast out of the pit will enter into him and possess him, analogous to, although a much lesser one, I'm sure, when Judas made his complaint about the woman with the alabaster box, then the scripture says, the devil entered into him and led him into his evil deeds. And in Judas' case, the devil had no more use for him after the crucifixion. So Judas returned to sanity, realized what he'd done, or it had done through him, and committed suicide. But it's not until that beast, the one that ruled Alexander the Great, comes out of the pit and possesses the man that has come up in the Middle Eastern area, that he becomes the demon-filled, devil-possessed Antichrist incarnate. And the beast is not the devil. The beast of the book of Revelation is not the devil. The beast of the book of Revelation is the one that is possessed with that demon locked up in the abyss since the death of Alexander the Great, who will come forth and possess him. The devil's still up there having access to the heavenlies as well as ruling down here. Then God will say enough and turn Michael loose on him, and he'll cast him out of the heavenlies. That's the second casting down. Jesus saw the first one when the crowning cherub, and there was war in heaven, and he was cast out. But in the book of Revelation, yet future, Michael will be turned loose. Between his first casting down, he still has access to the heavenlies. God didn't challenge him going up there to the councils of heaven. In fact, he says to him, you consider my servant Job? He still has access to the heavenlies. He's there to accuse us every day. as portrayed figuratively in the prophecies of Zechariah. When Joshua is a type of us, is clothed in dirty garments and is accused by the devil, and God says, shut up and take the dirty garments off of him and put clean garments on him, and Zechariah cries out for the fair mitre on his head. All these things are portrayed in God's book, and that's, as I said this morning, a temptation to use the occasion to entertain the intellect and not make sure that you're saved through this terrible time. The mobs are not going in. Few there be that find it. I think the rapture will take place, and there won't be enough go for it even to create much of a stir on earth. There are so few going to make it in the rapture. Otherwise, we would have biblical pictures of confusion reigning. And there's a great deal in the Bible about the decimation of population during the tribulation period, when wormwood hits and when the oceans and the waters turn to blood, and a third of this is gone, a third of that is gone, the rapture. It's just going to be written off to people disappearing, not very many of them. Few there be that go in thereat. Well, I want you in the service next Sunday. Only to use the word of the King James, the repented ones. But that doesn't even come close. Again, we've made void the word of God by our traditions. Satan is still going to and fro. He's not the beast, the Antichrist. He's an earthly ruler empowered by that demon out of the abyss. Satan's never been in the abyss. Since Adam and Eve were created, I don't know where he was before, he could have been, but since Adam and Eve were created, he's never been in the abyss. He's the prince of the power of the air. But God will turn Michael loose sometime during that tribulation period and cast him out of the heaven, and they'll sing for joy in the heavenlies. That irritant, that devil is restricted just to the earth, and knowing his time is short, he goes wild, even worse than he is. And then things, troubles as never were, as the prelude to the Battle of Armageddon. Now watch coming out of this. We're going to lose some more of our precious individual freedoms and rights. Just as the so-called war on drugs, it's the greatest failure maybe in the history of government activity. The only thing the government war on drugs has accomplished is take away some of we honest citizens' rights. Now you can't, under the constitutional right to travel, and I agree with it. It's the only way to handle it. But you can't drive in your own car to the airport without running the risk of random searches. Of course, because of drugs and criminality, a few recent decisions, pretty much ignored by the populace, take away most of your rights once you get in your automobile anyway. Can't live in a houseboat anymore. You don't have any rights there. And there's hardly a DA in America that cannot find a judge that will give him a search warrant for the least plausible causes. And that ancient system of the grand jury, that archaic vestigial remainder of an ancient time, pre-revolutionary, by the way, is nothing but a puppet of DAs and methods of getting around the constitutional protections on we citizens. Am I wanting to fight this? Absolutely not. Racial profiling goes with the territory. Goes with the territory. If there's anybody in America that doesn't have a right to say a single word about the killing of innocent citizens in Afghanistan, it's Muslims. Don't talk out of one side of your mouth and say, I don't want racial profiling, and then start mouthing off under the freedoms of this country that have opened their arms to your religion when no country that is Islamic will open their arms to the Christian religion. Don't start mouthing in criticism the innocent victims in Afghanistan. I got a PhD minor, unit minor in comparative religions from Stanford University. I have great respect for the honest and dedicated Islamic Muslims who are comparable to the conscientious and dedicated Christians. We don't share faith in terms of agreement any more than I am willing to fellowship with a Jew who shows no respect for the Christian faith in that Jew named Jesus. They don't have to accept my view of him, but don't try to deny his existence. And don't even try to deny that misguided leaders of a fanatical band of Judaism in that century instigated the charges of blasphemy and brought about, through their influence, the instrumentality of Rome to bring about the crucifixion. Did the Jews kill Christ? No. Religious leaders threatened by his claims. And most of the Jews in Palestine weren't even aware it was going on. Don't blame the Jews and make them do penance any more than I would blame the current generation in Germany and make them do penance for what their ignorant Aryan fathers, misguided, did. Don't blame me for the slavery in America. More blacks in Africa sold their fellow brethren into slavery than bought them over here. And more northern Yankees died and paid with their blood. And don't tell me that that was an economic war, not for the soldier on the front lines. He was there fighting for a principle against slavery. So more white blood was shed to set slaves free than any black blood that's been shed since that day on behalf of whites. So don't lay a guilt trip on me. I'm a good friend of Jesse Jackson, but we don't always share views. If you're going to be a Muslim in this state, be grateful for what is provided you, but don't start preaching. Just keep your mouth shut and go on about your business. Don't start preaching against what we're doing. Then you won't have any trouble from those of us that would fight for your right to have your faith here. Now, get on telephone. You have quite an investment in that Rose Bowl Aquatic Center. I think we are still the largest donor past the L.A. Times. I am still co-chairman of the board of directors at the Rose Bowl Aquatic Center. And they're having a special event this Friday night, not open to the public, to commemorate the accomplishment of our mission, which was to get it done for all these years. So, once again, we stand behind nobody, no church in this city, and our charitable activities for the good of the community. Just thought I'd remind you as we look at that beautiful. I didn't ask them to. And originally it was supposed to be done anonymously. But when you see that big Olympic high diving tower, you got Dr. Gene Scott across the front of it. That was the first contribution to build that tower, and then with our current mayor of Pasadena, Mayor Bogart, and Norm Chandler of the Times, who was his dream as a triathlon. He subsequently has died as a triathlon athlete. I was right there from the beginning and still co-chairman of the Aquatic Center. Now, no more phone calls. And I repeat, what has happened? God has pulled a chain. As time marches on, it's the function of the church to resist Antichrist. He can't come to power until the church is gone. In Thessalonians, he that letteth will let until it be taken out of the way. The spirit of Antichrist is already at work, but it can't come to fruition until he that letteth, old English, he that hindereth, will hinder until he be taken out of the way. That cannot be the Holy Spirit, because the two final witnesses, to just name that, are working during the tribulation when they come in the power of God as the final witnesses. Some say that's Enoch and Elijah, because those two did not die. Well, it's not that certain about Enoch, because the original is he was taken away from those who were watching him, the place that he was. Doesn't necessarily mean he was translated. Maybe he was. But we don't know what happened to Moses' body either. And of course, people assume that God buried him. No. Michael, read it in the book of Jude, Michael and the devil contested for the body of Moses. And Michael took that body somewhere. And I'm with the old preacher that says those two witnesses are witnesses. Now, what are they going to witness to? They've got to be witnesses who witness something. I know witness means martyr, and they certainly are going to be that. But they also come to bear witness in word, in testimony. Well, there were two witnesses on the Mount of Transfiguration that witnessed his glorification there. And they're named Elijah and Moses. And both Elijah and Moses were workers of miracles, and miracles of the kind that the final two witnesses were. Two witnesses of the resurrection. And one of the passages tells of them standing by. Two witnesses of the ascension. So I lean toward Moses and Elijah. Ain't gonna be bothered if it's Enoch. But the point I'm making now is the Holy Spirit has not left this earth. What has left this earth is the raptured church. And that's a meeting in the air. His feet do not touch this earth until he comes at the end of the tribulation, at the Battle of Armageddon. His feet touch the Mount of Olives, and it's split in the middle to create that rift through which those waters will flow to sweeten the Dead Sea when the temple is built during the millennium. It's all there in the book. And there is a controller of the time who pulls the chain. And these events that are happening in America, the most resounding effect of them is the breakdown of individual rights and a habituating to more government control in the name of security, and the willing, it's the necessary trade-off, the willing giving up of certain rights that move us toward that national identity card, national identity mark, the conditioning that began long ago with Social Security numbers, that which is absolutely necessary. I do not say the United States will not be cooperating. They will fall for it just like Israel. When that man to become Antichrist finally comes up with a peace plan for the Middle Ages. Middle Ages, Middle East. I mean, after all these centuries, I know as I was still trying to consider doing my work for a doctorate, planning to go to Cal, Stanford was a total turnaround. I started over in philosophy on the doctorate at Stanford. But I prepared to do a doctorate in political geography at University of California, Berkeley. I was applying for a Fulbright scholarship to go to the University of Beirut in political geography. And I wanted to focus on Israel. And I still remember my professor saying, "Why are you focusing on Israel? That's just a little country, a little storm for the present. Find some major country that will always be on center stage in world history." Yeah, ha ha ha. No matter what we try to do, Israel, Britain, America, inextricably tied together. And the beginning of Antichrist power, whomever he may be, he will come up with a peace plan for the Middle East. So, economically and in treaties, the United States will be intimately involved and will to the end, as will Britain. But that doesn't mean the United States or Britain will be part of that so-called 10-nation kingdom. That's a Middle Eastern conglomerate. In spite of all the theological and prophecy books that would have to be buried if what I'm saying is true, that's the way it's going to be. And as I have said, I'll bet my budget the Lord will not come by the Feast of the Trumpets in 2002. I will take my life. Don't have to. The word is clear. It's going to be a Middle Eastern kingdom. It's going to be part of the Roman Empire. Sure, the Roman Empire stretched all the way to the Euphrates River. What's the matter with you? The Romans conquered the Grecian Empire. It stretched to the Himalayas. And clear down into portions of India. The United States, and particularly the Celtic nations of Europe, are a different ball of wax. That's the House of Israel. And I am not a British Israelite. And be prepared to see a dentist if in my presence you call me that. That's a fanatical, idiotic cult raised up by the devil to turn Christianity off and religious scholars off until they were afraid to even talk about the divisions between the House of Israel and the House of Judah, and the division of the birthright between Judah that was given the right to rule and the right to make the laws, but the birthright belongs to the sons of Joseph. I've got hours on the lost tribes here. And it'd be a wonderful time to teach on prophecy, but I want to narrow it down to bin Laden. Here's a book, Study of Revenge. And I just wanted to put a footnote on what I said earlier. I'm not rejoicing over what happened, but it's God pulling a chain to create the necessary fear that empowers or softens us to let more government control take over, and government is the instrument of Antichrist. I like to read. I'm going to read like a woman. You ever get on an airplane? Do you get on airplanes anymore? You ever notice the women, when they get the magazine, they start reading from back to front? You ever notice that? I'm going to do that with this book. Chapter 20, conclusion. Lori Milroe. What happened? Did I miss something? Study of Revenge, Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War Against America. Lori Milroe, co-author of the New York Times number one bestseller, Saddam Hussein and the Crises in the Gulf. Don't go try to buy any books about Taliban, Muslims, Afghanistan. They're all sold out. Go buy stock in the companies that sell the books. Those books. Conclusion. Okay. I'm done. It is the contention of this book that the rash of... Now, this was written. Cost $24.95, by the way. AEI Press, American Enterprise Institute, Washington, D.C. See, this is not recent. This is not after the recent attacks. Copyright 2000. Recent, but not... It's prior to the Trade Center being demolished. It is the contention of this book that the rash of terrorist attacks directed at the United States, beginning with the 1993 bombing of the New York World Trade Center, does not represent an amorphous and therefore unpreventable new kind of terrorism. Rather, the United States is involved in a new kind of war. I'll give Bush credit for recognizing that. Thank God we didn't elect a president that's more worried about the environment. I don't ever reveal my political inclinations. But Bush was not my choice, if for no other reason, because so many fundamentalist Christians were for him. And anything Pat Robinson's for, I'm against. If Jerry Falwell's involved, I'm going to run the other way. I keep saying these things lest that the thought get out somewhere that I want them to somehow restore me. I want to rescue them. No, I really don't. But, you know, let's get it straight who's right around here and who's wrong. I mean, Jerry Falwell was on record out here once saying, I was off my rocker. Well, I've never had to apologize publicly in the newspaper for an idiot statement. Now, he did recently. You know, there's a religious mafia controlling this country. If you don't agree with them, you're out. Well, I never did get in, so I've really not been moved. Rather, the United States is involved in a new kind of war. An undercover war of terrorism waged by Saddam Hussein. That's not the name you thought you would hear, is it? Now, he's not the source of it. There's some other names you probably haven't heard. And the shining example leading the way in state-supported terrorism was Khomeini's Iran. and their puppet state, the Sudan, or Sudan. I saw a chilling nightline earlier this week, and something happened to my microphone, so get some of the bass out of it up there until I don't ruin my voice. Because something killed the sound all of a sudden, put all bass in it, and get it out. Puppet state, Sudan, and names that you probably haven't heard of. And Osama bin Laden is not some fanatical, bearded, ignorant Afghan living in a cave because he doesn't know any better and never had better. The man is an organizational genius beyond belief. Tab for major construction projects that has enabled them to hide, organizer of training camps, and presently the genius behind their financial network, that the best efforts to find those that profited by buying puts and selling short the industries to be most hit by the September 11th and subsequent happenings. Millions found the organizer of charitable institutions worldwide that would make Howard Hughes and his 300 and some corporations look like an amateur is this genius bin Laden. And the real question is not whether the Taliban will turn bin Laden over, but whether bin Laden will turn the Taliban over. But at this time, Saddam Hussein had moved into the vacuum. The greatest tightwalker of them all. And if this were the time, the most likely candidate for Antichrist running loose for several years. Because Antichrist must come out of Iran, Iraq, Transjordan, Syria. You're not going to come out of the United Nations. You're not going to come out of Rome. You're not going to come about as some Hollywood melodramas suggest. But when this book was written, the author is saying, rather, the United States is involved in a new kind of war, an undercover war of terrorism waged by Saddam Hussein. Or perhaps the terrorism is best characterized as a phase in a conflict that began in August 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and that has not ended. Our present president's father didn't finish the job. The issues at stake could not be more vital. They merit the most careful and most serious consideration. And right under the Secretary of Defense is one of the most brilliant men in the business right now, a hardliner who is not blinking, and at every session is saying, we got to go after Saddam. Well, the Secretary of Defense is one of the smoothest. I give Bush credit for assembling what I think is the best team for a crisis like this in recent history. But there's at least one man in Rumsfeld's department that is unbending, and he's a genius. We got to take out Saddam. A meticulous examination of the evidence from the first World Trade Center bombing trial, because the decision was made in the Clinton administration to treat it as a crime, which puts all the advantage on the side, and should, for we citizens of this United States, puts all the advantage on the side of the criminal. Doesn't happen much now. But the reason that a prosecutor, and my voice just came back, or my microphone, the reason that a prosecutor can file his papers under that prestigious name, Attorney for the People, that's me and you, he has that dignity and that advantage. He also has unlimited resources, whereas the defendant can only defend up to his resources, and that's why the rich don't go to jail in electric chairs and the poor do. Unlimited resources paid by my tax dollars, with the dignity and the prestige to stand in front of the judge as the attorney for the people. The counterbalance is, he must not seek to win, he must seek truth. The defense attorney does not have the obligation to tell all the truth. The defense attorney can be told by his client, I'm guilty. Now, we're in Anguilla. We have a full-time retainer, a very important and wonderful attorney on the island. He's a member of our board of directors of the corporations. But under common law, which accrues to that crown colony, if we had a lawsuit with someone on the island, if he chose, he could act for both sides. Because under common law, they're seeking truth all the way. That's why they had the Star Chamber, where you would take an ex officio oath to tell the truth, and if they couldn't prove you guilty, they'd already assumed you were guilty, and they therefore would hang you for lying against your ex officio oath. Because you swore to tell the truth, and they already decided you were guilty, and you're still saying you're innocent, you have to be lying, so hang you for lying, breaking your ex officio oath. That's why we have a Fifth Amendment in this country. The people that were revolting went through the terrors of the Star Chamber and the ex officio oath. You cannot be made to be a witness against yourself. So if I'm guilty, I can tell my attorney I'm guilty, but he's got a duty to be my advocate. He's not to lie for me, he's just not to tell the whole truth, which is a form of lying and withholding information. Now, if I tell him I'm guilty of this one, I'm going out and kill somebody tonight too. Then he has a duty to go to the police and report me for a crime I intend to do. But for the crime I did that he's defending me on, he didn't have to tell the truth. I am assumed innocent until proven guilty, and the burden of proof is on the prosecutor because he represents the people with unlimited facilities. That's why if he discovers a fact that proves that I'm innocent, he must walk into the courtroom immediately and dismiss the charges and reveal that I am innocent, even though that means he loses the case, because he's not pursuing a winning case, he's pursuing truth. That's the way it's supposed to be. Long since passed, that's the disgrace of O.J. Simpson. Doesn't matter whether you think O.J. Simpson's guilty or not. The prosecutor had no business using the perjury of a witness to convict. The prosecutor who is representing the people cannot use dirty tricks. They're to tell the truth. And we're dealing with terrorists who got here with premeditated lies. You can't make this a criminal case. You got to make it wartime. The issues at stake could not be more vital. You want me to continue? Get on the phone. Oh, I tell you, get on the phone, then tell you, get off the phone. So finish your calls. Now make sure that throughout this day you make your reservations for the festival, or for the service next Sunday, on the festivals that follow. Reading from Study of Revenge, Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War Against America, written copyright 2000. I repeat, it is the contention of this book that the rash of terrorist attacks directed at the United States, beginning with the 1993 previous bombing of the New York World Trade Center, does not represent an amorphous and therefore unpreventable, new kind of terrorism. Rather, the United States is involved in a new kind of war, an undercover war of terrorism waged by Saddam Hussein. But you're not the only state who sponsors it, by the way. Or perhaps the terrorism is best characterized as a phase in a conflict that began in August 1990 when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and that has not ended. The issues at stake could not be more vital. They merit the most careful and most serious consideration. A meticulous examination of the evidence from the first World Trade Center bombing trial suggests that the bombing is best, chapters 3 through 9 in this book, I'm just reading the conclusion, I've read the book, suggests that the bombing is best understood as a, quote, false flag, end quote, false flag operation run by Iraq, leaving the Muslim extremists who participated in the conspiracy behind to be arrested. In this case, to be suicide bombers. And you know, it doesn't take a great deal of mystery to think that guys that are going to get on a plane in New Jersey and know that they're going to die one way or other for a few hours go by, that they would have any concern or risk about exposing themselves to anthrax to mail the letters. Doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. That in fact, that false flag operation run by Iraq, leaving the Muslim extremists who participated in the conspiracy behind to be arrested, the 1993 bombing, that, in fact, is what the majority of New York law enforcement agencies involved in the investigation believed at the time. The second New York bombing conspiracy began as an FBI undercover operation aimed at teaching the local Muslim extremists a lesson. Sudanese intelligence became involved, has since been officially acknowledged. The Clinton administration seems to have concluded that Sudan was fronting for a third country, Iran, which is true. The selection of bombing targets is suggestive, however, as was discussed in Chapter 14, but I'm reading the conclusion. Iraq is a far more likely suspect than Iran as the hidden hand in a bombing conspiracy whose principal target was the United States, the United Nations. Those two plots, both occurring in the first 6 months of 1993, gave rise to the widespread view that a new form of terrorism had emerged that did not involve states. But there was really nothing new in the terrorist attacks. What was new was the approach taken by the United States. The Clinton administration allowed the all-important national security issue of state sponsorship to be obscured, at least in the public mind, by the legal issue of the guilt or innocence of individual defendants. Now, I don't think to my audience I have to interpret. What a wonderful plan. Take advantage of all the national sovereignty rights, seats in the United Nations, diplomatic immunities, voice in the media, all the power of a modern state with no recognition on the part of that modern state if it is a fundamentalist Islamic nation whose goal has nothing to do with national state lines. It's pan-Islamic unity. One God, Allah, ruling the earth through His law, Sharia. A foothold, be it a square inch, in the name of Allah, expand to the hub of Islam, and ultimately rule the world where all that is needed is in the Quran, as interpreted by the religious leaders through their fatwas, the equivalent of papal encyclicals. Control the mind totally. The end justifies the means to bring the world under Allah's control. Stamp out the infidels. Supranationalism to a world pan-Islamic state, nation. Subnationalism based upon clans and ethnicity. It had nothing to do with the modern state. It's about as much sense as trying to divide the Sioux Nation or the Cherokee Nation by states drawn up in the early days of Washington. Indian tribes whose identity with their land is not going to be removed by drawing a circle and creating a reservation and moving them there. Still their land. They haven't changed even till today. Still their land. And the dream of these pan-Islamists was the first state overthrowing what they consider to be lackey and servile, evil, apostate leaders in Muslim lands who were propped up and supported for economic reasons by these Western nations, particularly the United States and its power. And their first great resounding victory was the removal of the Shah and the forming of the modern Islamic fundamentalist Khomeini state in Iran. The next one was the Sudan, and with Sudan on the other end, in the hub of Islam, they were going to press to the center, driving Israel out as occupiers of their land and turning the Red Sea first into an Arab lake, which explains all the turmoil on the Horn of Africa. Right in the middle is Bin Laden. But the Clinton administration allowed the all-important national security issue of state sponsorship to be obscured, at least in the public mind, by the legal issue of the guilt or innocence of individual defendants, as if we're dealing with a bunch of fanatical individuals. Now, that may be the case in the microscopic conflict between Israel and the PLO. There you may have cases where the bubble of comprehension is reduced down to getting the hated Israel out of Palestine. And there you may have emotion-laden children raised with a limited passion to throw Israel into the sea. But the world terrorism threat, that's like a side room. It's not the main room. Oh, it's a main issue because it's the focal point of a hated Western imposed, in their view, intrusion into their holy land. that Clinton and his administration allowed the public to think this is an issue of individual terrorists. We've been duped. And it must be handled as a criminal act and go through the long process of proving guilt. The legal question was, of course, handled as a public matter in criminal trials. And the national security dimension of the terrorism was never publicly addressed. The White House apparently believed that it had dealt adequately with the problem of state sponsorship by striking Iraqi intelligence headquarters 2 days after the arrests of the conspirators in the second bombing plot, as was suggested by the official leak to the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. Subsequently, the administration added Sudan to the State Department's list of terrorist states. But dealing with terrorism in that fashion had far-reaching consequences. The lack of a public discussion of state sponsorship obscured Saddam's policy of vengeance, while it gave rise to the misleading notion that the terrorist threat had assumed a new form, radical Muslims acting on their own without state support. And the strike on Iraqi intelligence headquarters could not deter Saddam forever. The next major terrorist bombing conspiracy targeted at Americans was Ramzi Youssef's aborted plot to bomb 12 U.S. airplanes in January 1995, discussed in Chapter 15. Notably, none of those convicted for that conspiracy were Muslim extremists, including Youssef. Their ethnicities, Baluch and Uzbek, belonged to the remote fringes of the Islamic world, were unfamiliar to most Americans, yet trained in the same terrorist network. And until the current military replacement of Bhutto's government, whose pro-Muslim terrorists, Pakistan was one of the major staging and training areas for terrorists. And I said I saw a chilling nightline. Some of you may have saw it. A beautiful, charismatic 10-year-old boy addressing a screaming anti-American crowd with a speech of hatred and annihilation of all Americans anywhere, any place, that would make Billy Graham look like a beginning evangelist. Spellbinder. And then it fades to the background of schools all over Pakistan where kids as young as 3 and 4 years of age, 12 hours a day, sitting with the Quran open, memorizing 12 hours a day, short breaks for food, natural needs. Memorizing the Quran in Arabic in a language they don't understand. Until at 10 and 12 years of age, they can quote vast amounts exactly in verbatim in Arabic from the Quran, brainwashed in the hatred of the United States as the enemy of Allah, not the enemy of Pakistan or Afghanistan, the enemy of Allah, the enemy of God and all who worship it or him. who are then trained in their hatred diatribe, trained even in emotions. Talk about Svengali, a national Svengali, brainwashing these kids until a 10-year-old kid who for 6 years, 12 hours a day, has been trained in the words and in the gestures and the intonations, totally brainwashed with a total hatred whose only goal in life is to kill Americans, and thereby gain access to choice position in paradise with Allah. The newsman interviewed him. He's just as cold as steel. He doesn't understand what he's saying, but he knows the target, and he's totally committed. This is his reason for living, is to kill Americans. And we expect dropping leaflets on Afghanistan to change the mind of someone when the leaflets are in Spanish and English. And we expect that we can convince that child, I don't understand why he hates us. Why does he hate us, Americans? We're good people. All over Pakistan right now, those schools are operating, totally brainwashing and training a generation of killers for Allah. The current military dictatorship holds its power by force and cannot survive in its current stance. It must join the pan-Islamic unity and the fundamentalist drive to spread the Islamic faith with the sword or terror, or be put in the category by these fanatical fundamentalist Muslims, pan-Islam, from Indonesia to the Sudan and into Africa, and with cells in every major country of the world. To be called by them apostates, sleeping with the infidel. Now, this state of mind did not happen overnight. Osama bin Laden, his father, became a favorite of the House of Saud in Egypt. I mean, in Arabia, Saudi Arabia, became a favorite of the House of Saud. He obtained major contracts and became a billionaire many times over with more than 50 children, don't know how many wives. And Osama bin Laden was one of those well-educated and brilliant teenagers who did his nightclubbing and playboying in Beirut in its swinging days, womanizing, drinking, bar brawls. His father got the contracts to refurbish the two holiest sites, Mecca and the other holy site in Saudi Arabia, which, in theory, the Saudi house is the protector of for all Muslims, their holy sites and their return to Mecca. In refurbishing these holy places, Osama's father experienced a tremendous religious conversion, became not just nominal Muslim, dedicated, transformed by his faith, Muslim. The teenager, a young man who had all the money in the world that he could spend, playboy in the night spots of Beirut, as he said, came home to help his father in this construction project and was gripped as he worked on these holy sites with the same religious fervor. Became very religious. Highly educated, but with a sense of purpose and dedication to Allah, and at that point extremely loyal to the House of Saud. Studied at the university in Jeddah, where intellectuals gathered, and he came under the influence of names that I haven't time to mention in this half hour, and with a passion, joined with the Afghan fighters to throw out the Soviets. Became a hero, like David in biblical sense. 6'5", marveled at by those who fought at his side and with him, because he's always right on the front line. Absolutely fearless of death, totally committed as a holy warrior for Allah. His organizational genius and the dedication of his portion of funds from the family won him devotion beyond belief, as only more than women, men can know that most men see a man they'd like to be like. And though he's being denigrated and should be for his evil deeds and his warped views, as a man he was a hero and became one quickly, leading the fighters in throwing out and organizing camps of training and motivating people to come from Egypt and Saudi Arabia and other places to throw out the infidels that were occupying Afghanistan. And when they had the victory of throwing the Russians out, his name was made. He still was loyal to the House of Saud. Came back, settled down to what seemed to be a peaceful role with his father in construction business, and then came the war over Kuwait. He went to Kuwait, tried to persuade them to let him lead the battle against another Muslim state, Sunni in that case, against, by contrast with the Shiites, who would form and did form Iran. He could not persuade them that if Afghanistan could throw Russia out, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia could hold their own against Saddam. And he recognized there were enough Muslims in Iraq that they, as we're seeing Taliban fighters change sides, would change sides. Couldn't persuade them. The family left. With their riches and their means, they left. The ordinary people in Kuwait were facing the advancing army. He then went to the Saud house, offered all of the bin Laden construction equipment, and his knowledge of what he has built, that's why we're not finding him in Afghanistan, what he would do to build fortifications and protections for Saudi Arabia. Don't let the West come in. The Saudis, again, feared Saddam and made the agreement with the West to stage soldiers and airfields in Saudi Arabia. Vice President Cheney was on record, then Secretary of Defense, calming some of the critics, a leading voice of which was bin Laden, that the U.S. troops would not stay 1 hour beyond the victory where they were needed to defeat Saddam Hussein. They're still there. And it was that. He was a critic during the war, but still a supporter of the Saudi house. And of course, there's another little history stream flowing there that King Faisal who was almost worshipped by the people, was assassinated by a deranged nephew, and the fundamentalist Islamists credited the insanity of that nephew that killed the beloved king to his exposure to the Western insanity and corruptions in Beirut and the rest of the world that his riches took him to. And the mounting resentment of the West's involvement in this holy land, as they stayed after the war, made bin Laden an open critic of the Saudi house. He was threatened with possession of all of his assets and had to flee the country. Then the philosophers that had trained him, who congregated, who had trained him at various universities, brilliant PhDs, who felt that Christianity itself had lost its nature by the corruption of materialism and the corruption of the Western world and its morality, or lack of it, under their influence, the Khartoum conferences began to form, and a state-sponsored terrorism was launched, and that's where I'll take up when I get into this book and begin to read it to you again. If you want me to continue now or later, you